Go talk to someone who's actually making these claims. That would be my advice to the San Antonio troll. We've got a great bonus show for you today. There is one Republican senator ready to vote to move forward with debating a major Democratic voting rights bill, and that's Lisa Murkowski, one Republican senator. We'll talk about that. Number two, the American Psychological Association is now apologizing for previously perpetuating systemic racism. What did they do? We'll talk about it. Is their apology substantial? We will talk about it. And lastly, Colorado hospitals are now in a position where they may need to turn patients away because of a resurgence in COVID cases, and they are going to be allowed to do it. We're going to talk about all of those stories and more on today's bonus show, which you can get instant access to by becoming a member at joinpacman.com. If you'd rather do the pledge via Patreon, that will also get you access to the bonus show. You can go to patreon.com/DavidPacmanShow. Producer Pat will join me. Great bonus show. Otherwise, we will.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh, yeah. Bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Dog in Pittsburgh, WRCT.
I'm Senator John McCain, and I'm from Arizona. But when I'm in Pittsburgh, I always listen to WRCT, one of the finest stations in all of radio, and Carnegie Mellon University is one of the finest academic institutions in our country. Be sure at your next election to vote early and vote often.
You're listening to WRCT Feedback Radio.
RCT Pittsburgh. Meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Hi, we're the Deliverance Strangers, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Things get brighter day by day when you listen to the Big W. Life is lighter in every way when you listen to the Big W. So laugh it up and let yourself go with King Size Radio, the Big WRCT, Radio Carnegie Tech.
This is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
From New York, Rock Raider.
Yeah, yeah, 1-2, Total Eclipse.
From Executioners, and we chilling on WRCT.
Word up, Pittsburgh representing 88.3 FM.
Check it out, all right?
All right, peace.
WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM rocks.
This is Martin Atkins from Pigface, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Hey, this is Marlon Saunders, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hey, this is Steve Archer.
And Donna Lynch.
From Ego Likeness, you're listening to WRCT Radio.
It's E. Dueto from the Love Dogs, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT. WRCT.
We own
everything.
And your soul is next.
We don't actually have the legal documentation to back that up.
Hovland, you're listening to 88.3 WRCT FM, Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh.
Yo, there's only 6 degrees of separation, and we know 5 people you know. How much longer did you really think you could avoid strict flow? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM, like this.
WRCT Radio 900.
WRCT Pittsburgh. We love monkeys.
Hey, this is Grant Lee Phillips telling you, if you're wondering where you're tuned to, it happens to be 88.3 FM, radio's finest, WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Arr, I'm from creationist crucifixion.
Arr, I'm not attractive and I'm from steel curtain.
Me neither, arr.
WRCT,
Pittsburgh, 88.3, arr.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The children cannot live on words and empty promises. They are waiting for you to act. Please open your hearts.
Youth activists are taking to the streets of Glasgow today to demand world leaders do more to avert a climate catastrophe. We'll get the latest and hear a moving address by a youth climate activist from Kenya. But first, we speak to civil rights attorney Ben Crump.
When you look at the video, it harkens back to yesteryears, things we thought we had overcome in America. I mean, it looks like it's a lynch mob chasing a young black man, and when they kill him, there is no accountability. They go home and sleep in their beds at night.
We'll look at the murder trial of three white men, one of them a former officer, who hunted down and killed black jogger Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia, as well as the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, the white teenager who fatally shot two protesters at an anti-police brutality protest in Kenosha, Wisconsin. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Representatives of over 40 nations have pledged to end the use of coal power. The deal announced at the COP26 UN Climate Summit in Glasgow did not include China and India, which account for two-thirds of worldwide coal consumption, nor did it include Australia, one of the world's two biggest coal exporters. The Biden administration also refused to sign the pledge to stop burning coal in an apparent concession to Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who has resisted Biden's push for U.S. investments in green energy. Meanwhile, youth activists are taking to the streets of Glasgow today to demand world leaders do more to avert a climate catastrophe. The protest is organized by Fridays for Future, which grew out of Greta Thunberg's climate strike outside the Swedish parliament. We'll go to the COP26 climate summit inside and out later in the broadcast. On Capitol Hill, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi scheduled votes today on the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the Democrats' Build Back Better Act. The votes come after months of negotiations and delays as Democrats whittle down their expansive social safety and climate package following myriad objections from conservative Democrats, many of these coming from Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Those negotiations continued into Thursday as President Biden reportedly made calls to a number of Democratic lawmakers and his questions remained over several key issues, including immigration and the plans budget. Youth climate activists confronted Senator Joe Manchin Thursday, demanding he back the Build Back Better Act and its provisions to combat the climate crisis.
We want to live! We want to live! We want to live! We want to live!
Activists this confronted Manchin multiple times Thursday, including blocking his Maserati, as they demanded to know whether their futures were worth the profits he makes in chanting, "We want to live," as he slowly tried to drive through the crowd. The protests were led by five young people who earlier this week ended a two-week hunger strike demanding real action on the climate crisis from Congress. You can see our interview with one of those hunger strikers at democracynow.org. The White House has announced COVID-19 vaccine mandates covering more than 100 million workers. Beginning on January 4th, workers at private sector companies that employ at least 100 people will have to be vaccinated against COVID or be tested weekly. Unvaccinated workers will also be required to wear face coverings on the job and may have to pay for their own tests. A separate rule will require some 17 million U.S. healthcare workers be vaccinated by January 4th with no testing option. The Biden administration's cut ties with vaccine maker Emergent BioSolutions after it ruined millions of doses of Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccines at its factory in Baltimore, Maryland. The company will forgo $180 million of its $628 million contract to produce vaccines for the federal government. Moderna said Thursday it'll deliver 300 million fewer doses of its highly effective COVID vaccine this year than initially projected. Even so, Moderna Thursday reported $3.3 billion in third quarter profits. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, protesters rallied outside Moderna's corporate headquarters Thursday, carting in wheelbarrows full of fake money covered in blood, as they demanded Moderna share its vaccine recipe with producers in the Global South. This is Dr. Joya Mukherjee, professor of global health at Harvard Medical School.
We delivered this blood money to the steps of the Moderna headquarters, and we've stood for 5 minutes in silence. 1 minute per million people who have died, the large majority of them without access to the vaccine. We must force Moderna to work with a long list of manufacturers around the world who are ready, who could actually scale up this vaccine.
Anti-war advocates are condemning the Biden administration for proposing a new $650 million missile sale to Saudi Arabia, warning the move will only trigger more death and suffering in Yemen. If approved by Congress, this would be the first major military sale to Saudi Arabia since President Biden took office and vowed the U.S. would end support for offensive operations. In response, Code Pink tweeted, quote, "Meanwhile, one Yemeni child continues to die every 10 minutes as a result of the humanitarian crisis caused by the Saudi-led war on Yemen," they said. In Chile, security forces shot dead two indigenous Mapuche leaders during clashes Wednesday in the province of Arauco. The southern coastal region has been under a state of emergency since last month, with the Chilean government deploying 2,000 soldiers to the region as it attempts to suppress the Mapuche community and their fight to recover their ancestral lands. The U.S. Congress has approved a new bipartisan sanctions bill targeting the Nicaraguan government ahead of the country's presidential election Sunday and in response to President Daniel Ortega's crackdown on the opposition. Ortega is seeking a fourth term. About 40 opposition figures, including seven presidential candidates, have been arrested since June. The legislation seeks to monitor and address human rights abuses and the obstruction of free elections by the Ortega government. Opponents say more U.S. sanctions will continue to harm the Nicaraguan people and are demanding the U.S. government stop its catastrophic intervention in Nicaragua. In The Hague, three leading press freedom groups this week launched an unprecedented tribunal charged with holding governments accountable for the rising violence against journalists. The People's Tribunal on the Murder of Journalists is being spearheaded by the Free Press Unlimited, the Committee to Protect Journalists and Reporters Without Borders. For the next 6 months, the tribunal will hold hearings on charges against the governments of Sri Lanka, Mexico, and Syria, accused of failing to protect journalists and allowing their killers to act with impunity. This comes as UNESCO has released a new report that documents an 87% impunity rate in cases of murdered journalists between 2006 and 2020. The Justice Department is suing Texas over its recently passed voter suppression law, saying it violates federal voting rights laws by targeting Texans of color, voters who don't speak English, and voters with disabilities. In related news, the Republican-controlled North Carolina legislature Thursday approved extreme gerrymandered redistricting maps, giving Republicans an outsized advantage that could last for the next decade. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper, who's a Democrat, does not have veto power over redistricting plans, so any challenges to the new maps would likely go through the courts. In other news from North Carolina, dozens of Democratic state lawmakers staged a walkout earlier this week after the House swore in its newest lawmaker, Republican Donnie Loftus, who admitted he was present during the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Bloomberg reports Manhattan prosecutors have convened a second grand jury to continue probing the financial practices of Donald Trump's real estate empire and to weigh possible criminal charges. A previous grand jury convened by Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance indicted the Trump Organization and its former CFO, Alan Weisselberg. In Kenosha, Wisconsin, the judge overseeing the trial of teenage gunman Kyle Rittenhouse has removed a juror who was overheard joking about the shooting of Jacob Blake, the African-American man left paralyzed last year after he was shot by Kenosha police. Judge Bruce Schroeder agreed with prosecutors that the juror's comments were disqualifying.
It is clear that the appearance of bias is present. And it would seriously undermine the outcome of the case. I think the best thing under the circumstances, I'm going to dismiss you from the jury, sir.
Meanwhile, in Georgia, opening arguments begin today in the murder trial of the three white men who hunted down and killed black jogger Ahmaud Arbery last year. Only a single black juror was chosen. The 11 others are white. After headlines, we'll speak with Ben Crump, attorney for Ahmaud Arbery's family. Oklahoma's Pardon and Paroles Board has recommended clemency for Julius Jones, an African-American man sentenced to die for a 1999 murder he says he did not commit. Calls are mounting for Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt to halt Jones' execution, scheduled for November 18th. Meanwhile, a judge has denied a request to grant a new murder trial to Rodney Reed, an African-American prisoner sentenced to death by an all-white jury in 1998 for a crime he has always denied committing. Lawyers say there's compelling evidence that another man may be responsible for the 1996 murder of Stacy Stites, a 19-year-old white woman. You can see our coverage of both death penalty cases at democracynow.org. On Wet'suwet'en territory, the Gimten clan is marking over 40 days since they set up new blockades preventing Coastal GasLink from drilling on indigenous land to build their pipeline. The occupation started in September and halted the company's efforts to build a key portion of the over 400-mile pipeline that would transport natural gas from the Dawson Creek in northeastern British Columbia to the province's north coastal region of Kitimat. This is Sledo, also known as Molly Wickham, a land defender and matriarch of the Gitimden clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation.
There's now a clan cabin on the drill pad site where CGL plans to drill under Woodzinqua. In 2010, there were 13 proposed pipeline projects to go through Wet'suwet'en territory. Investors were forced to pull out of these mega destructive projects through our territory, and Coastal GasLink pipeline is the only one left. From Enbridge, Pacific Trails Pipeline, Spectra, Pembina, and several others.
To see our interview with Slato, please go to democracynow.org. And in labor news, striking Alabama coal miners returned to New York City this week to bring their protest to the offices of hedge fund BlackRock, the largest shareholder of Warrior Met Coal. Six rallygoers were arrested during a peaceful sit-in protest. 1,000 members of the United Mine Workers of America have been on strike for over 7 months. This is union leader Brian Sanson.
Same executives ran the company into bankruptcy, ran it in the ground. Bought non-union mines that lost millions of dollars. misled investors, cut benefits off to 2,500 retirees, cheated the pension plan out of $1 billion, cut workers' wages by $6 an hour, eliminated future health care, future pensions for these workers, all while asking and getting bonuses from the bankruptcy court.
Meanwhile, 34,000 Kaiser Permanente health workers on the West Coast have authorized a strike starting November 15th unless their demands for fair pay and staffing are met. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to the two trials in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and in Georgia around the killing of the black jogger Ahmaud Arbery. We'll speak with Ben Crump. Stay with us.
A moving feeling within me that I was sitting there demanding a God-given right, and my soul became satisfied that I was right in what I was doing. At the same time, there's something deep down within me, moving me, that I could no longer be satisfied or go along with an evil system. I had to be maladjusted to it. And in spite of all of this, I had to keep loving the people who denied me service, who stared at me.
Interlude, Loving the People by Michael Kiwanuka. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Before we head to Glasgow for the UN Climate Summit, we're going to stay right here at home in the United States. The murder trial begins today of three white men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery, the unarmed 25-year-old black man who they chased down and shot to death while he was out for a jog last year in the suburbs of Brunswick, Georgia. Many have compared his death to a modern-day lynching. A warning to our viewers and listeners, this segment contains graphic descriptions of violence. On February 23, 2020, Gregory McMichael and his son Travis McMichael saw Arbery jogging, grabbed guns, and pursued him in a pickup truck. Their neighbor, William Roddy Bryan, joined the pursuit in his own truck, recording the video on a cell phone. The McMichaels claim they were attempting a citizen's arrest of Ahmaud. Travis McMichael fired two shots, killing Ahmaud. The elder McMichael was a former Glynn County police officer and investigator for the Brunswick Judicial Circuit prosecutor Jackie Johnson, who was indicted for directing police not to arrest Travis McMichael and then steering the case to a sympathetic prosecutor. It was a third prosecutor who ultimately filed the murder charges in the case after the video evidence became public, sparking widespread outcry. More than a quarter of Glynn County is black. But after a long and grueling process, just one person, a single black man, was chosen to serve on the jury in the case, along with 11 white people. The judge, Timothy Walmsley, declined to change the jury's racial makeup after prosecutors asked him to reinstate eight black potential jurors, arguing defense lawyers struck them because of their race, which is unconstitutional.
The court has found that there appears to be intentional discrimination in the panel. That's that prima facie case. And I guess before I get into this, one of the challenges that I think counsel recognize in this case is the racial overtones in the case. Quite a few African-American jurors were excused through peremptory strikes exercised by the defense. But that doesn't mean that the court has the authority to reseat.
So that's Judge Walmsley, who said he believed there was intentional discrimination in the choosing of the jury, but went ahead with the racial composition of the jury, ultimately 11 white people and one African-American. Arbery's family has said they're concerned about getting a guilty verdict. This is the family's attorney, Lee Merritt, and Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, speaking to reporters Thursday outside the courthouse in Brunswick, Georgia.
It's like unreal. I mean, I just can't put it into words. I was very shocked that we only had one black African-American man. And I mean, that was devastating.
For a family who just wants to hear, they just want a fair day in court without racial bias, but it's inherently built into our system. We need to continue to work to change laws and improve our system so that it doesn't continue, but it's there.
This comes as Judge Walmsley ruled Thursday the jury will not see a toxicology report showing Arbery had a small amount of THC, the psychoactive compound in marijuana, in his blood. This is the judge's exchange with one of the defense attorneys.
It brought up a small amount of THC. Yeah. I don't know what that small amount of THC means.
You're going to prevent us from going into toxicology. You're going to prevent us from talking about corroboration of THC use, excessive THC, unless perhaps we can come back and educate the court on THC use in of itself causing aggressive behavior, confrontational behavior, outside and isolated from mental illness diagnosis. That was my question to the court, and I think the court's ruled.
This comes as lawyers for Travis McMichael, who shot Arbery with a shotgun, have tried to limit evidence that suggests race was a motivating factor, including photos of his vanity license plate with a Confederate flag on it on the front of his pickup truck. For more, we're joined in Chicago by civil rights attorney Ben Crump, who's one of the lawyers for Arbery's family. Ben Crump, welcome back to Democracy Now! In a moment, we're going to talk about the Rittenhouse trial. But right now, we're going to talk about the murder case of Ahmaud Arbery. Talk about what's happened so far. It took a long time to impanel this jury. A quarter of the county is black, more than a quarter of a county. There's only one black juror. Explain what happened.
It's very disappointing, Amy, not only for Ahmaud's mother and father, but for everybody who's been following this case. The fact that you seem to have a jury that has more of the perspective, more of the commonalities with the killers of Ahmaud Arbery than the perspective of Ahmaud Arbery, this young black man who literally was killed for jogging while black. And it's troubling because the court, when they granted 24 peremptory strikes from the beginning, that was troubling because she said, they can systematically try to just strike black people 24 times. That's too many strikes. So everybody who's been looking at this case is saying that not only from the day one when the police came out and tried to give cover for the killers of Ahmaud Arbery for jogging while black, it seems that our criminal justice system gives them cover, too, when they're being brought to the Tribunal of Justice.
And talk about Walmsley, the judge. It wasn't the prosecutor or defense or an activist who used this term, intentional discrimination. It was the judge himself who seemed furious that he couldn't do something. He said, he admitted, there was intentional discrimination here. This involves the Batson challenge, if you could explain what that is.
Certainly. The Batson challenge is a Supreme Court edict based on case law that says you cannot dismiss people based on their race, ethnicity, or their gender. You have to have race-neutral reasons why you're dismissing people from the jury panel. I think the judge was being very honest and truthful when he said it appears that it was intentional discrimination. I don't know how you can conclude anything else. However, the family would have liked for him to dismiss this panel so we could have a panel that was a jury of Ahmaud Arbery's peers who would sit in judgment concerning whether the killers will ever be held accountable. So it is very troubling, Amy, again, that you only have one African-American juror who's going to hear this case.
So I want to bring in the other case, and then we'll talk about both. This is the Wisconsin case. Opening arguments have just begun in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, the white teenager who faces seven charges, including homicide, for fatally shooting two men and wounding a third amidst the anti-police brutality protests in Kenosha last year. There's only one person of color on that jury. The judge overseeing the trial has ruled the three protesters that Rittenhouse shot, killing two, wounding the third, cannot be labeled victims during the trial, but can be called rioters, looters, or arsonists if the defense can provide evidence to justify such terms. This week, the judge removed a juror who was overheard joking about the shooting of Jacob Blake, the African-American man left paralyzed last year after he was shot by Kenosha police. According to CNN correspondent Omar Jimenez, the juror approached a deputy and asked, "Why did it take seven shots to shoot Jacob Blake?" Then he answered himself, "Because they ran out of bullets." Judge Bruce Schroeder questioned the juror about his conduct, then dismissed him, citing the need for public confidence in a fair trial.
It is clear that the appearance of bias is present, and it would seriously undermine the outcome of the case. I think the best thing under the circumstances, I'm going to dismiss you from the jury, sir.
So he's been kicked off the jury, but he was chosen to be on the jury. Can you talk about the composition of this jury and what's at stake and the video that's new video that's been released showing Rittenhouse opening fire?
Yeah, you know, the similarities in the two cases are quite shocking when you think about the video shows both of the killers in these cases actively pursuing people who are unarmed. And that has to say something about our system of justice where we're at in America today. You cannot allow people to hunt down individuals with shotguns and assault rifles, and then there be no accountability. Then there seems to be a suggestion that the criminal justice system will protect certain people but condemn others who had no weapon. When you think about all these minorities, especially black men in the criminal justice system and the prison industrial complex, where there was no video evidence, it was based on just innuendo, circumstantial evidence, but we can always find a way to convict them. However, when this white man shooting unarmed people, it seems that it's such a challenge to convict them. It talks about the need for us to finally confront the original issue in America, and that is racism and discrimination.
I wanted to ask one more question about the judge, Bruce Schroeder, in the Rittenhouse case. Addressing the jury, he evoked the Bible to explain the hearsay rule.
This is actually referred to in the Bible. St. Paul, when he was put on trial I think it's Caesarea. It was over in Palestine, in Israel. He was accused of some activity, and he was a Roman citizen, which was not common. But he happened to have been a Roman citizen, and so he has rights that we share now as Americans.
The judge also used his position on the bench to slam media coverage of the Rittenhouse trial. Here he's criticizing CNN for questioning his edict to attorneys not to refer to any of those shot by Rittenhouse as victims.
This was on CNN. Jeffrey Toobin and another attorney there. And the comment was made that the ruling was incomprehensible. And I think they obviously are not familiar with this rule. That's our law.
The significance of this, Ben Crump, evoking the Bible, invoking the Bible, and then this whole issue of not being able to refer to the men who were killed as victims, but possibly as rooters or as looters or arsonists?
It is very questionable when you think about the fact that the defense should be able to do everything they can to zealously defend their clients, but also the prosecutors have to be able to zealously prosecute the case. And so you can't put shackles on one party and let the other party have an unfair advantage. And so what we're trying to get, Amy, is a system that would allow due process for everybody involved. And that's why I continue to say we can't have two justice systems in America, one for Black America and another for white America. We have to have equal justice for every citizen in the United States of America. And obviously, my heart breaks as I sit here and I think about that juror telling the joke about our client, Jacob Blake Jr., and why it took 7 bullets to stop him. And his response was, because we ran out of bullets. How do you think that makes Jacob Blake feel as he sits paralyzed today watching coverage about 3 people shot who was protesting for him to get a chance at justice, which he was denied because no charges were brought? There are 2 justice systems in America, and we have to continue to fight to say that we all need 1 justice system, not when white men shoot people, they're treated differently. When Black men are accused of shooting people, the book is thrown at them. That's why we fight so hard, Amy.
Ben Crump, I want to thank you for being with us, civil rights attorney representing the family of Ahmaud Arbery, as well as the Jacob Blake family. Next up, youth activists are taking to the streets of Glasgow today to demand world leaders do more to avert a climate catastrophe. We'll get the latest and hear a moving address by a youth climate activist from Kenya. Stay with us.
What else could I write? I don't have.
Apologies, performed by Sinead O'Connor. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Youth activists are taking to the streets of Glasgow today outside the UN Climate Summit. They're demanding world leaders do more to avert a climate catastrophe. The protest is organized by Fridays for Future, which grew out of Greta Thunberg's climate strike outside the Swedish parliament. She began the strike in 2018 when she was in ninth grade. Now Greta is 18 years old, and she's in the streets of Glasgow today. She was speaking earlier this week.
They're just politicians and people in power pretending to take our future seriously, to pretending to take the present seriously of the people who are being affected already today by the climate crisis. Change is not going to come from inside there. That is not leadership. This is leadership. Yeah! This is what leadership looks like.
Youth climate activists have also been given a prominent role inside the UN Climate Summit this year. Let's turn to one of the highlights of the opening ceremony Monday.
My name is Elizabeth Kwathuti. I am a youth climate activist from Kenya. I need to tell you what is happening in my home country. Right now, as we sit comfortably here in this conference center in Glasgow, over 2 million of my fellow Kenyans are facing climate-related starvation. In this past year, both of our rainy seasons have failed, and scientists say that it may be another 12 months before the waters return again. Meanwhile, our rivers are running dry. Our harvests are failing. Our storehouses stand empty. Our animals and people are dying. I have seen with my own eyes 3 young children crying at the side of a dried up river after walking 12 miles with their mother to find water. Please open your hearts. This is not only happening in Kenya. Over the past few months, there have been deadly heat waves and wildfires in Algeria and devastating floods in Uganda and Nigeria. And there is more still to come. By 2025, in just 4 years' time, half of the world's population will be facing water scarcity. And by the time I'm 50, the climate crisis will have displaced 86 million people in sub-Saharan Africa alone. Please open your hearts. If you allow yourself to feel it, the heartbreak and the injustice is hard to bear. Sub-Saharan Africans are responsible for just 0.5% of historical emissions. The children are responsible for none, but they are bearing the brunt. We are the adults on this earth right now, and it is our responsibility to ensure that the children have food and water. I have been doing what I can. Inspired by the great Professor Wangari Maathai, I founded the Green Generation Initiative, a tree-growing initiative that enhances food security for young Kenyans. So far, we have grown 30,000 fruit trees to maturity, providing desperately needed nutrition for thousands of children. Every day, we see that when we look after the trees, they look after us. But these trees and the life-saving fruit they bear will not survive on a 2.7 degrees Celsius warmer planet. The decisions you make here will help determine whether the rains will return to our land. The decisions you make here will help determine whether the fruit trees we plant will live or perish.
decisions you make here will help determine whether children will have food and water. I believe in our human capacity to care deeply and to act collectively. I believe in our ability to do what is right if we let ourselves feel it in our hearts. So for these next 2 weeks, let us feel it in our hearts. The children cannot live on words and empty promises. They are waiting for you to act. Please open your hearts and then act. Thank you.
That's Elizabeth Watuti of Kenya speaking at the opening ceremony of the UN Climate Summit on Monday. And as we broadcast right now, thousands of youth are in the streets in Glasgow protesting for climate justice. As we continue on the UN Climate Summit, representatives of over 40 nations have pledged to end the use of coal power. The deal announced at the COP26 summit in Glasgow did not include many of the largest coal producers, including China, India, Australia, and the United States. To talk more about the state of the climate summit, we're joined by Mina Raman. She's head of programs at Third World Network, usually based in Penang, Malaysia, now joining us from Glasgow. Behind her, the rotating globe that's suspended over the UN Climate Assembly. Mina Raman, talk about the significance of these 40 countries committing to ending the use of coal, but the major users from the United States to China refusing to participate in this.
Well, Amy, I think what we need to recognize is that all these sideline pledges or announcements actually need to be reflected in the real commitments which are under the convention and the Paris Agreement. A lot of these announcements are all outside of that process. So, of course, I don't think you can put the U.S. on the same level as China and India, because the U.S. is a much bigger historical emitter than China or India. And China and India, and I've said constantly previously before, they do have huge challenges because of large emissions coming because of large populations. So in terms of per capita, US is still much higher than China and India. So the point I'm making is that you can't say put them on the same platform together. And the second point I'd like to make also is that what's critical is to recognize the energy poverty that many of these, the developing countries face. So we do need to phase out from fossil fuels. But what's fundamental is that there has to be on the basis of what's called just transition, so that the people who are energy poor, the more that they have access to renewable energy, the more that we ensure that they are not the victims of climate solutions. So having said that, I do think that all countries need to do much more, not just on coal, but fossil fuels as a whole. But the developing world does require large amounts of financing, large amounts of technology transfer for the kind of transformation that needs to happen. When the rich world has not been able to phase out fossil fuels, which it ought to have done by today, and yet it continues to expand the use of fossil fuels, it's really dubious to preach to the developing world that that they have to get out of fossil fuels. So the leaders, and this is recognized by the treaty itself, the Convention and the Paris Agreement, those with the greatest responsibility, historical emissions and current cumulative emissions together, they have a huge responsibility for the current warming. And this has been pointed out also by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in relation to the large amounts of CO2 which have been emitted, which are causing much of the impacts that we face today.
Can you explain the 1.8 degree Celsius that now is being put out as the goal?
No, that's it. 1.5. It's not 1.8. If you recall in Paris, the agreement in the Paris basically says that countries will ensure that the global temperature goal will be limited to well below 2 degrees centigrade from pre-industrial levels, and they will pursue towards 1.5 degree centigrade. Now, we all know as climate justice groups that the 1.5 is a much safer guardrail. But the issue really here is that when particularly the rich world talks about, we need to achieve the 1.5 degree limit, the devil really is in the detail of how to get there. Now, when you have a 1.5 degree limit compared to a 2 degree limit, the amount of carbon space or the atmospheric space that you have left is much smaller than under a 2-degree limit. So the issue really is that, as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has pointed out, if you add all the emissions from the historical and you take the cumulative into account, we only have something like 500 gigatons of carbon space left. This means that at the current emission trends, we will exhaust this carbon budget for limiting temperature rise to 1.5 with a 50% chance. And that itself is a problem. So
let me clarify something, Mina.
This 500 gig.
The number has always been 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. And scientists have said that global warming must be kept to this above pre-industrial levels. But I thought what has come out now is that the International Energy Agency reported Thursday that warming could be limited to 1.8 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels by 2100.
Yeah, they were referring to the methane and other initiatives and cooling and so on, and they have come to 1.8. Now, I have not seen the details of the report, but I think that what we need to recognize, Amy, is the fact that whether it's 1.8 or 1.5 or even 2 degrees, with the push for net zero by 2050 by all countries, and this is being pushed right from the UN top level, right down to the UK presidency, we in civil society, in the climate justice movement, are very critical of that. Because it is about, if you look at US saying net zero by 2050, and other developed countries saying net zero by 2050, and if you look at the content of that, that's actually doing too little too late. And net zero will exhaust with the net zero distant targets of 2050, there is no time for 2050. And you actually need to get to real zero today. It actually should have been done yesterday by the rich world in particular. So we need to recognize the fact that we are not going to be able to limit temperature rise either to 1.8 or 1.5 or even 2 degrees if we allow the rich nations to keep to net zero by 2050. This is too little, too late. And net zero, what it actually means is that you don't decarbonize. Every ton of carbon that you emit, you're going to plant a tree to absorb that carbon. It doesn't work that way. Science does not work that way. So we are being told about these net zero targets, and it's an illusion. It's really a complete illusion. And we are very worried that there is a lot of greenwashing which is happening here. A lot of it is about, if you look at the targets, they talk about carbon credits, offsetting. Offsetting, it's not about decarbonizing. Decarbonizing means you remove emissions and you also plant trees to increase the things. But what's happening here is that net zero through carbon offsets, which means that the developing world will have to do much more of the heavy lifting again. And this doesn't work. It's the time for carbon offsets is over.
I want to get your comment on the first week of the talks. And, of course, we'll be with Glasgow all next week. President Biden came. He was one of the openers of the UN Climate Summit. But right before he came to Glasgow, he was in Rome at the G20 summit, and he held a news conference when he was asked about his call for the world's largest oil producers to increase output. This is what he said.
You also met with energy consumers about supply. What steps are you considering taking if OPEC Plus does not raise supply? And do you see any irony in pushing them to increase oil production at the same time that you're going to COP26 to urge people to lower emissions?
Well, on the surface, it seems like an irony, but the truth of the matter is you've all known, everyone knows, that the idea we're going to be able to move to renewable energy overnight and not have, and from this moment on, not use oil or not use gas or not use hydrogen, is just not rational.
Meena Raman, if you could respond to what Biden said.
Well, his response is completely irrational. And it really is about the hypocrisy of world leaders like him coming to COP26 and saying that we need to do more. Now, if the rich world cannot get off their oil addiction, and if they cannot, it's not just about renewable energy. More importantly, it's also about consumption patterns and production systems. So the consumption, we can't be being oil addicts or fossil fuel addicts, actually. And so we do need to move. The transformation is phenomenal, but Biden has no excuse to say what he said.
I want to thank you so much, Meena Raman, for joining us, head of programs at Third World Network. She traveled to Glasgow from Penang, Malaysia. We end today's show with Barbados Prime Minister Mia Mottley. She spoke at the opening ceremony on Monday.
The pandemic has taught us that national solutions to global problems do not work. We come to Glasgow with global ambition to save our people and to save our planet. But we now find three gaps. On mitigation, climate pledges or NDCs. Without more, we will leave the world on a pathway to 2.7 degrees. And with more, we are still likely to get to 2 degrees. These commitments, made by some, are based on technologies yet to be developed. And this is at best reckless and at worst dangerous. On finance, we are $20 billion short of the $100 billion. And this commitment, even then, might only be met in 2023. On adaptation finance remains only at 25%. Not the 50-50 split that was promised nor needed, given the warming that is already taking place on this earth. Climate finance to frontline small island developing states declined by 25% in 2019. Failure to provide the critical finance and that of loss and damage is measured, my friends, in lives and livelihoods in our communities. This is immoral and it is unjust. If Glasgow is to deliver on the promises of Paris, it must close these three gaps. So I ask to you, what must we say to our people living on the front line in the Caribbean, in Africa, in Latin America, in the Pacific, when both ambition and regrettably some of the needed faces at Glasgow are not present? What excuse should we give for the failure? In the words of that Caribbean icon, Eddie Grant, will they mourn us on the front line? When will we, as world leaders across the world, address the pressing issues that are truly causing our people angst and worry, whether it is climate or whether it is vaccines? Simply put, when will leaders lead? Our people are watching, and our people are taking note. And are we really going to leave Scotland without the resolve and the ambition that is sorely needed to save lives and to save our planet? How many more voices and how many more pictures of people must we see on these screens without being able to move? Or are we so blinded and hardened that we can no longer appreciate the cries of humanity? I have been saying to Barbadians for many years that many hands make light work. Today, we need the correct mix of voices, ambition, and action. Do some leaders in this world believe that they can survive and thrive on their own? Have they not learned from the pandemic? Can there be peace and prosperity if one third of the world literally prospers and the other two thirds of the world live under siege and face calamitous threats to our well-being? What the world needs now, my friends, is that which is within the ambit of less than 200 persons who are willing and prepared to lead. Leaders must not fail those who elect them to lead. And I say to you, there is a sword that can cut down this Gordian knot, and it has been wielded before. The central banks of the wealthiest countries engaged in $25 trillion of quantitative easing in the last 13 years. $25 trillion. Of that, $9 trillion was in the last 18 months to fight the pandemic. Had we used that $25 trillion to purchase bonds, to finance the energy transition, or the transition of how we eat, or how we move ourselves in transport, we would now today be reaching that 1.5 degrees limit that is so vital to us. I say to you today in Glasgow that an annual increase in the SDRs of $500 billion a year for 20 years put in a trust to finance the transition is the real gap, Secretary General, that we need to close, not the $50 billion being proposed for adaptation. And if $500 billion sounds big to you, guess what? It is just 2% of the $25 trillion. This is the sword we need to wield. Our excitement 1 hour into this event is far less than it was 6 months ago leading up to this event. Can we, with those voices and these speeches from Sir David and others, find it within ourselves to get the resolve to bring Glasgow back on track? Or do we leave today believing that it was a failure before it starts? Our world, my friends, stands at a fork in the road. One no less significant than when the United Nations was formed in 1945. But then, the majority of our countries here did not exist. We exist now. The difference is we want to exist 100 years from now. And if our existence is to mean anything, then we must act in the interests of all of our people who are dependent on us. And if we don't, we will allow the path of greed and selfishness to sow the seeds of our common destruction. The leaders of today, not 2030, not 2050, must make this choice. It is in our hands. And our people and our planet need it more than ever. We can work with who is ready to go, because the train is ready to leave. And those who are not yet ready, we need to continue to ring circle and to remind them that their people, not our people, but their citizens, need them to get on board as soon as possible. Code red to the G7 countries. Code red to the G20. Earth to COP, that's what it said. Earth to COP. For those who have eyes to see, for those who have ears to listen, and for those who have a heart to feel, 1.5 is what we need to survive. 2 degrees, yes, SG, is a death sentence for the people of Antigua and Barbuda, for the people of the Maldives, for the people of Dominica and Fiji, for the people of Kenya and Mozambique, and yes, for the people of Samoa and Barbados. We do not want that dreaded death sentence. And we've come here today to say, try harder, because our people, the climate army, the world, the planet, needs our actions now, not next year, not in the next decade. Thank you.
That's Barbados Prime Minister Mia Motley addressing the UN Climate Summit opening ceremony on Monday in Glasgow, Scotland. To see the whole opening ceremony, we'll link to it at democracynow.org. Next week, we'll continue to bring you Climate Countdown, our comprehensive coverage of what's happening at the UN summit, as we have for every UN Climate Summit since Copenhagen in 2009. Featuring voices inside the COP, climate activists protesting outside, and advocates from the global south who couldn't travel to Scotland during the pandemic. More than 100,000 people are expected to be in the streets of Glasgow on Saturday. We'll air highlights on Monday. You can visit us at democracynow.org to see all of our coverage this week. And that does it for our show. Happy birthday to John Hamilton. Democracy Now! Has job openings at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe.
So there's been this massive robbery of the population for 40 years and has its effects on the way the government works. That's why you end up with, say, 90% of the population being basically unrepresented. And these struggles go on constantly. They're going to go on in the post-pandemic world. It's a radical class struggle. But only one element in the struggle is always fighting. The business world. They're dedicated. They never stop. Unless working people, general population, take part in the class struggle, they're going to get it in the neck.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Noam Chomsky on class struggle or get it in the neck. The ruling class, and there is such a thing, assiduously attends to its needs. That is to say, to maintain and expand its power and wealth. How does it do that? By manipulation, propaganda, and political influence. It deploys divide and rule tactics to not only distract most people, but goads them to turn on one another. The idea is to get people to look down and not up at those who are on top. So your class enemy is not gazillionaires such as Jeff Bezos or Mark Zuckerberg, but it's the poor guy down the street, out of work, behind in his rent, and his family doesn't have enough food to eat. The boot is on his neck. How to get it off? Organize and resist. Our guest today is Noam Chomsky, the legendary scholar activist who has been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. Chris Hedges says he's America's greatest intellectual who makes the powerful as well as their liberal apologists deeply uncomfortable. I talked with Noam Chomsky on November 30th. He was at his home in Arizona and I was in Boulder. Let's start with the pandemic. Excuse this crude expression, but Americans are dropping like flies, a death a minute. NPR reporting a dire picture around the country. Hospital resources are stretched thin. New York Times headline, as surge spreads, no corner of nation is spared. If this is not a national emergency, I don't know what is. What must be done?
What has to be done is to follow the advice of the scientists and of the countries that have successfully managed it. It is not inevitable. We can see this from the fact that other countries, rich and poor, have handled it pretty well. China, for example, is just back to work. There are very few cases. Vietnam, right on the border of China, almost no cases. New Zealand, basically under control. Australia, pretty much under control. Taiwan, Senegal, Kenya, Nordic countries are not too bad. There are places that have more or less managed, which tells us, and they're countries of a very diverse kind, which tells us that it is possible, but not without leadership that most of the time even denies that it's happening, which filters down to the population. We've seen reports of people in, say, the Dakotas dying in hospital beds of COVID.